in the second century, I think it was about the year 155, a very old man named Polycarp, who had been a disciple of the Apostle John and a Christian, it seems, from childhood, was arrested and condemned to burn at the stake. But before they lit the fire, they told him one last time that if he would deny the Lord, that his life would be spared. And this is what he said: 86 years have I served him, and he has never done me any harm. Why should I forsake him now? And Polycarp burned that day for the name of his Lord and Savior. Similarly, another faithful old man, a man of God named Daniel, we're going to be reading about a story in his life this morning. He was probably about that age. He was in his upper 80s at this point. And he had a whole network of people who conspired against him and ended up being condemned to death. Only in Daniel's case, God showed his supreme sovereignty over the great king of the world at that time and delivered his servant. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 6. I'll read about this story of Daniel in the lion's den. Verses 1 through 9, our first point here, we'll look at how this conspiracy against Daniel was formed. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. And then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. And then these men said, "We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." And then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows: "King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked." Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. So here you have this great conspiracy against Daniel by these folks who had really grown jealous of him. The king had set up some kind of hierarchy of leadership where he had 120 people who were ruling over the various provinces of the kingdom, and over them you had three, and over them the one was distinguishing himself above the others in order to kind of keep law and order in the kingdom and keep some kind of continuity and taxation, make sure everything was working out smoothly. It was common for conquerors such as we see throughout the ancient Near East to, once they overtake one kingdom, to kind of use the leadership that was already in place and put them into place. And that's what this king does in this case. And he uses Daniel. You remember at the end of chapter 5, when the great Babylonian kingdom came to an end and Darius received the kingdom at the age of 62. So this here is sometime after that, probably not very long, but already Daniel is excelling above the rest and quickly rose to the top. And as often is the case, that made those who he was rising above jealous. And so they joined in this collaborated effort to search for corruption in Daniel's life in order to bring him down. They expected to find some kind of dirt on the man. Who doesn't have some skeleton somewhere hidden in a closet, right? And so they dug and they dug and they could find nothing. His life was marked by integrity. Notice there were mentioning here, there's not even negligence was found. They couldn't even find sins of omission, things which he was not doing, which he should have been doing. Not only was he not doing things wrong, he was making sure he did all the right things. He was truly a remarkable man. And this after an entire lifetime of political service. Good luck finding somebody like that today. And here you have his enemies who are looking for something. Usually enemies are able to find problems even where they don't exist. And yet their conclusion was that he was innocent. And what kind of man is this who has his whole life turned? I mean, you know what happens when a judge before a judge is appointed, he's named and he kind of goes through the ringer, doesn't he? I mean, Congress and everybody, they're scrutinizing his life. I mean, that sort of thing was going on here. His life was turned inside out. You got people who are vying for office, and the opponents are always, in our day, in a democracy, they're fighting, looking for anything they can, any dirt they can to expose it, to bring him down. And you can't help but think of us and how this can touch us and how we live. Do we live with this kind of integrity, or is our life really marked by hypocrisy, and do we live with a facade? What would happen if our lives were investigated this way and turned inside out? What kind of financial practices would be uncovered? What kind of integrity of speech do we use? Are words really honest, and are they marked by things like truth, or do we use manipulation and dishonesty? How do you treat your family behind closed doors? What kind of things do you do when no one else is around? These are the kinds of things which they were searching for in his life. Someday, these very kinds of things are going to be exposed. We may never be put forward in some kind of political game like this, but there is a day of judgment. There is a day of exposure where our insides are revealed. Paul talks of this in 1 Corinthians 4, verse 5. He says, when the Lord returns, he will bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the secret motives of men's hearts. Jesus also talked this way in numerous places. In Luke 12, he says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. There is nothing covered up that will not be revealed and hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in the inner room shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. Exposure like this doesn't have to be a problem, though. We don't have to hide in the dark because we're afraid of being exposed. In fact, Paul says in Ephesians 5 that we shouldn't be participating in unfruitful deeds of darkness anyway. Instead, we should be looking to expose those things in the dark, because those things done in the dark are generally disgraceful even to talk of, much less participate in. Jesus says those who hate the light, what do? They run for cover. Those who love the light, who walk in the light, they don't mind that, because their deeds, when exposed, are shown to have been wrought in God. They're shown to come out of a work of God in your life and done in the glory of God. And so we shouldn't have to hide. If there are things in our lives which we're hiding, things which we don't want to be exposed, things which we would avoid some context where somebody might find out what we're doing, the call here is come out of hiding. If we're living if you're living as a hypocrite, it's going to cripple you. It has an effect not just emotionally in terms of the burden that you carry of a guilty conscience, but it has an impact on you physically, doesn't it? We saw some of that last week in our Sunday school class, where when you live with guilt and a guilty conscience, it really starts to chew you up from the inside out, doesn't it? It just eats you up. And it turns you away from others, really, so that you become so self-focused, it's difficult to really love. Just constantly in fear of being caught. Well, here, they found nothing like that in Daniel. There was no ground for a charge. They said, unless, of course, we find a problem with the way that he follows his God. This is where they were going to be able to nail him. You see, people competing for positions of power, they are very willing to look for something and find something. And they will even take good people down. Here was a man who was probably not too hard to get along with, and yet they didn't mind tearing him down at all just because of their jealousy. And one charge that you can always get to stick against a man of God, a genuine worshiper of God, is his exclusive religion of this one God. Isn't that true? I mean, the goal is create some kind of conflict between the man's allegiance to God and his allegiance to those other human rulers or human authorities, other people who he's supposed to have some kind of loyalty to. And that was the way that they were going to get Daniel in trouble. See, proud people generally, if they're in leadership and have authority, they don't like to share that. They don't want to have to turn you to some higher authority or higher power. Absolute authority, however, belongs only to God. And God has given positions of authority on a human level to people for them to serve under him. And so when a man, just a human person, has authority, it is not his to possess and rule over people absolutely, no matter how powerful the kingdom or the nation may be, no matter how powerful the state or the workplace, no matter how powerful. We, in every authority situation, always answer to a higher authority in God. And so when God calls people to submit to those lower authorities, he's never calling for them to submit to those lower authorities absolutely. The authority that we have to submit to when we submit to a boss or a country or a nation or the government is never divorced from our ultimate authority of God. We always submit to him first. And so when there's conflict, it's God who wins. When there's some tension, we always honor the Lord before we honor some human authority. When it doesn't work that way, when it works that way and in the mind of the human ruler who is proud and who clings to these positions of power and authority, in their mind, this person is acting in treason. And in their mind, the person is acting in rebellion and is not faithful or loyal. You remember what happened with Peter and John, for example, in Acts chapter 4, verse 19, when they were arrested and questioned by the Jewish religious authorities. They were said, don't preach anymore in the name of this Jesus. And they answered, they said, whether it is right in God's sight for us to listen to you rather than to God, you be the judge. They went on in chapter 5, verse 29, in a second arrest, second situation, they said, we must obey God rather than men. We are not going to stop speaking. Indeed, we cannot, because of our submission to the Lord and because of what he's done in our hearts to transform us. It wasn't this the very tension between political leadership and submission to God that they even accused Jesus of, right? That was what the Jews accused him of before Pilate. That was the thing that got him in trouble as far as the Romans were concerned. They accused Jesus before Pilate. They said, we found this man misleading our nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king. He is king. And you remember just before the crucifixion, as Pilate's trying to get Jesus released, he makes the statement, what should I do to your king here, this king of the Jews? And remember what they screamed out? We have no king but Caesar. And these were Jews who were saying that. People who actually said that they believed in the one true God. Yeah. In John chapter 19, verse 12. They said, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar, speaking to Pilate, who was trying to release him. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. You cannot serve both God and or both Caesar and any other higher god or ruler. This is the logic that the Jewish leadership was using, because they knew this was the only thing they could get to stick against Jesus. These guys here in Daniel's day were using the same kind of thinking. They knew that if they could create some conflict between Daniel's loyalty to Darius on the one hand and loyalty to God on the other, that they would be able to find the problem to put him down. And so they carefully constructed this law. They put into effect this idea, and they brought it to the king. They knew they could have a law that Daniel wouldn't be able to keep by requiring all prayer, even for just a short period of time. They didn't need much time. It was just a month here. But require all prayer to be given to the king alone. And so they manipulated Darius into signing it into effect. Now, something like this wouldn't have been an uncommon thing in that day for a king to attribute to himself some kind of deity and assume the honor and praise which belongs to a god be given to him. They didn't see much distinction between gods and men in that day, right, in their polytheistic way. And in fact, that's what most false religion does, is it lowers the view of God down and makes God more like men, and in doing that, they make themselves more like God, and they blur those distinctions. And so to call a man a god and to pray to him that way is not much of a stretch. And this made good political sense for the king to do as well, because here you have this vast empire made up of various nationalities and only recently falling into his hands. And here he is trying to distribute leadership among these 120 men who are leading all over the place. And if he can do anything to facilitate unity and to assure himself that the people are loyal to him in this empire, he was all for it. He was probably also flattered by the way these men came to him, in that all these men, all these rulers and officials have gathered together, and we agree, they said, they were lying to his face, but we agree that you alone should be prayed to for this period of time. And so they appealed to his foolish pride, they appealed to his vainglory, and he fell for it, didn't he? Yeah, here's a clue. If anyone comes to you and builds you up in this way and tells you you can be a god, right, that God was once a man like us and now you can be a god like him, I guarantee you it's a trick. Don't fall for it. The king fell for it. He fell into the trap and signed this injunction. And according to the law of the Medes and Persians, something which we don't have a lot of record about, there was at least this one fact, and that is that it couldn't be revoked. There was some higher law than the king himself in terms of his authority to speak. And the reason for this restriction that any law signed into effect by a king couldn't be revoked was, ironically, to emphasize and to highlight the king's authority. That is, a king, when he says something, it cannot be questioned. Even by the king himself, that's how much authority he possesses. And so here you have the king's power stripped from him by a rule and a law of the land intended to emphasize the king's infallibility. And here he was being very fallible. Point two, Daniel's faithfulness demonstrated in response to these circumstances in verse 10. So now when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he entered his house. Now, in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Fascinating verse. Daniel knew that the document was signed. He knew it. I mean, here he is. He goes on, does his business like he'd always done before. He didn't miss a step. He didn't change a thing. He knew the document had been signed and yet was unmoved by it. He was not intimidated by any kind of threats. He probably even suspected that he was being set up. He'd been in politics for a lot of years by this time, right? Probably some 75 years maybe in politics, and he'd seen how these things go, right? He'd seen how people can manipulate things and how people are always backbiting and stabbing you in the back, things like that. And so here it was, a choice to follow God, submit to the Lord, or bow to these situations, this circumstance. And he knew that following God could be costly, and he was not moved by the intimidations and by the threats. He had no way of knowing, of course, that by following the Lord he'd be delivered. In fact, all the evidence pointed to certain destruction. After all, the law of the king could not be revoked. And yet his faith and his hope was not in the king. His hope was in a God who he knew to be faithful. He knew that God would protect and provide if it were the Lord's will. And he also knew that man, in spite of the law of the Medes and the Persians or any other law, can do nothing if it's apart from, or unless it's according to God's will. God's sovereign over everything. And this is the nature of trust, isn't it? To entrust oneself over to God, to let the results fall according to His will, and focusing instead not on trying to manipulate the circumstances to have things work out our way, but instead to do what pleases Him and leave the results to God. God will take care of us if it's His will, and He will always work these things out for good. We don't have to worry about trying to make our choices based upon how we think it'll best turn out for our sake. Instead, we want to make our choices based on what God has communicated to us. And that's what Daniel did. He trusted in God in spite of the apparent risk and the difficulty of the circumstances which he was entering into. And so what did he do? He went up into his room, opened up his window toward Jerusalem like he always did, and prayed. This was not a prayer of panic. This wasn't like the guy in the foxhole with the bolts flying over his head offering up that once-in-a-lifetime prayer, "Lord, if you get me out of this, I'll make it all work better now." This was a prayer of a man of prayer, praying as he always prayed. It says specifically three times a day, morning, noon, night. In spite of a busy schedule that a man like this would have as a high official within the king's court, he was looking to God. God was the one who was his hope. God was the one who had made himself known to Israel throughout their history. He was the one who called for worship, and he called for it there in Jerusalem. In fact, this place of Jerusalem where God had made his presence known and through the temple and tabernacle through all those years, this is the place that God called for people to come and worship. And now that place, that city was in ruins still to this day after some few decades since the Jews were exiled out of that land. The temple laid in ruins and the people were all in exile. And Daniel was looking for the restoration of the nation. He was looking for the people to return. Look over in Daniel chapter 9 briefly. Just in terms of the structure of the book of Daniel, the first six chapters, each one deals in sort of a narrative story. They all tell a story about some event in the life of Daniel, or in a couple of cases, the life of his friends. And they demonstrate God's sovereignty over their lives and protection over them as individuals, but also his sovereignty over the nations, the kingdoms. And in beginning in chapter 7, he kind of ends the narrative section of the book of Daniel and begins these various prophecies and interpretations of these prophecies, which will occupy the rest of the book, which we'll be going through beginning next week. But here in chapter 9, notice the first couple of verses. "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of Median descent, who was made king over the kingdom of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, observed in the books the number of the years which was revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah, the prophet, for the completion of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years." So here you have Daniel, and by the way, it's not all chronological once you begin in chapter 7. It's not like all that starts at the end of chapter 6. These prophecies took place at different places throughout his life, which we've been going over now in the last 6 weeks. But here in Daniel chapter 9, he's talking about the first year of the reign of King Darius. Now, here we are in chapter 6, in the reign of King Darius, probably sometimes shortly after this account in chapter 9. And Daniel, having already seen this and learned what he learned from chapter 9, is facing Jerusalem, right? He's looking back to the restoration which is promised in Jeremiah. That is, that after 70 years, these things would be restored. In Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 10 through 14, it says this: "For thus says the Lord, when 70 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you and fulfill my good word to you. I will bring you back to this place, for I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope." He's saying all this in spite of the fact that they're in exile. Right here, the people were getting, in Jeremiah's day, they were getting ready to be sent out, captured by Babylon, and sent away for these 70 years. And he's saying, but you have a long-term perspective, there's future and hope. "And then you will call upon my name in that day, there will come a time where you will call upon my name and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you, and you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. And I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and I will restore your fortunes, and I will gather you from all the nations and from all the places where I have driven you, declares the Lord. And I will bring you back to the place from where I sent you into exile." And so here you have Daniel looking back, seen in the book of Jeremiah, not just in chapter 29, but in chapter 25, verses 11 and 12, this reference to these 70 years which separate the exile to the return. And he's coming to the end of that. He's an old man now, some, again, 85, 90 years old probably at this point. And he sees, whoa, we're almost done with this. This 70 years is up. And that's where we pick up in chapter 9, which we're not there now. The point is, here in chapter 6, he sees this and he's setting his mind back to Jerusalem, longing and praying for the fulfillment of God's promises, which were soon to take place. And so Daniel kept doing what he had always done. He opened his window to Jerusalem and prayed. Look at verses 11 through 16. Here you have the king's distress when he realizes what he had done. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? And the king replied, "This statement is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked." And then they answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. And then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. And then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed." And then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. These officials knew exactly what they were doing in creating this law and getting the king to sign it. They knew Daniel would keep on praying, and they knew where they'd find him, and they knew what time of day. All they had to do is arrange together their lunch break and meet there outside in view of his window, and they knew what they would see and hear. Apparently, they didn't even have to worry about keeping it secret from him. Daniel, it says, remember, knew that this injunction had been signed, and what did he do when he heard that it had been signed? He went right back up and did what he'd always done. Right? They seem to have known. They could have hidden it from Daniel, perhaps, but they didn't need to. They didn't have to worry about it. They were that confident about what Daniel would do. They knew that they wouldn't move him, even by a threat of death. They needed to approach the king carefully, however, because the king, he liked Daniel. He had a good relationship with Daniel. He was a trusted subject of his, and one that he was about to put in charge of everything. And so they brought the charge, but they did it with gentleness. And finally, they brought the charge against Daniel directly and said, "Daniel pays no attention to you, and he keeps on praying three times daily. He didn't listen to you, king. He doesn't care about you." They made it personal. The king immediately, however, realized that he had been duped. He had been told that he would be a god for a month and instead turned out to be a fool. Darius's relationship was with Daniel, and it was strong. He was an old man by now, Daniel was, and Darius himself was probably in his mid-60s. Daniel in his later 80s, as I said, and maybe even 90. He was an old man and still in the same place. So now that the Medes or Persians had taken over, it wasn't as though they left the city. It was still the city of Babylon. It was just under a different ruler, a different empire. And so here the king had made a very foolish mistake. He, by his pride, had basically been taken away. And now it was going to cost him dearly. And so notice it says that he spent the rest of his day looking for some kind of loophole, some way to get Daniel out of what this problem was he created. Contrast Nebuchadnezzar's fiery rage in chapter 3. Remember when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they didn't bow down at the king's rule, the king's order. Everyone's got to bow down to this image that I've created. And they stood there, remember, as these little pegs in the midst of the sea. That's kind of how it was, of all these bent backs. That's Nebuchadnezzar was outrageous. Like, he was so upset with these men. And he sought instead to turn the oven up 10 times hotter or something like that. You remember that? Well, here you have this man actually looking for a way to deliver Daniel. And when the officials got wind of what the king was trying to do, they got a little nervous and had to come back to the king to remind him. So you can't take this back. This is the law of the Medes and the Persians. This is irrevocable. And so the king had no choice. Daniel had to be thrown to the lions. But look at how the king responds to the situation in the second half of verse 16. The king spoke and said to Daniel, when he realized the inevitability of what was about to happen, that you were going to be thrown into the lion's den, he said, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." And notice on your outline there, this is kind of the central point of the whole chapter, isn't it? This statement by the king that your God will certainly deliver you. Or maybe not certainly, I don't know how certain he was, but the one that you constantly serve, he will deliver you. You see, Daniel's loyalty to God had made a very deep impression on the king. Darius knew that Daniel's fear of God wasn't a threat to his own authority as king. Daniel's submission and loyalty to the king was unparalleled, in spite of the fact that he served a higher king, a higher God. So Daniel, in submission to his God, made him a better subject of the king, not worse. And Daniel had learned this already. Darius had learned this. Daniel had also undoubtedly taught and explained these things about God and told of stories which God had done for their people. Darius is learning something about Daniel's God through his testimony. I mean, obviously, Daniel's life had been blessed by God to have this kind of wisdom and this kind of influence on nations, not just one nation, but multiple nations, and on the people around him to rise to this kind of prominence, not once, but more than once. And so he spoke about God, and he showed through even the miracles that we've already seen in the first few chapters what kind of God he served. So these things may have been out of the king's hand. That is what would happen to Daniel. But the king recognized that Daniel's God is certainly a God who can deliver. And so the king was distressed nonetheless. Though he had some kind of ray of hope here in making a statement like that, it was mixed with a great deal of trouble. He was sad. Here he was about to throw his friend and his confidant here into a den of lions. Let's read verse 17 and 18. A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den after he was thrown in, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring. This ring isn't something which is like a lock. I mean, the sealing is not like a lock which is padlocked. It's more like clay which is soft and pushed against the rocks, and then the signet ring is pushed into the clay such that if the rock is moved, the clay breaks and it shows that somebody had tampered with it. So he sealed it with his rings and then the rings of the nobles so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. And then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. And no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. These lions, I mean, imagine this kind of thing. Is our ways of execution as barbaric as this? It doesn't seem like it, does it? Maybe it would be if you weren't a part of our culture. Maybe electric chairs and lethal injection seems barbaric, but this seems pretty barbaric, doesn't it? I mean, these animals probably fed only enough so they'd be hungry and aggressive enough to really deal with these executions effectively. The den is probably built out of a side of a hill, with an entrance in the side. That's where the stone would have been rolled over, but there would have been an opening. They found at least one of these in archaeological work over in Morocco, and this is how it was built, where there was an opening, sort of a mouth of it at the top, and a wall that surrounded it around that opening that people could actually look over and watch. It was a spectacle on some level. And so in the middle of this, there was a wall that separated the two sides of this den underneath with a door that could be opened from the top so that you could kind of coax the animals into one side so you can get on the other side and clean it out and do it the other direction if you needed to. This is probably something like what was going on here over in Babylon, is you've got this den filled with these animals, barely fed, barely kept alive, and now you've got a problem, right? And so the night was one for the king which was sleepless. He was disturbed. He went to bed without eating, without entertainment. This was quite a sacrifice for him. The kings, they had a pretty luxurious life. And it was surprising that he took it so hard, given the brutality that a man like this would have been accustomed to. For Daniel, the night went much better. He didn't have the problems that were anticipated for him. Let's go ahead and read verses 19 through 23. And the king arose at dawn and at the break of day. He went in haste to the lion's den. And when he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, Has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And Daniel spoke to the king, "O king, live forever." Perhaps the king was hearing his voice before he even got to the opening to see him for himself. "My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also towards you, O king. I have committed no crime." And then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. The king rushed out first light. His voice shaky, maybe, says he was troubled. The language here is that he was sad. There was a sadness, a sorrow after this long sleepless night, worrying about Daniel. And he cries out with these amazing words, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you? Has your God been able to deliver you?" It's remarkable that he held out any hope at all, isn't it? I mean, not many people went into a lion's den and then came out the next day in one piece, much less alive. And yet here was Daniel, unscathed, untouched, unscratched. But here you have this polytheistic, self-worshipping king who had learned something about Daniel and something about Daniel's God, that here is a man and here is a man's God who is different than what I'm used to. And so he had hope. There was some kind of ray of hope in the man's mind and his voice. What a testimony this Daniel must have had on this man. Isn't it amazing? And notice how Daniel is referred to by the king. Imagine if you had a boss and you had developed some good relationship with this boss and you were faithful to him as his employee and that sort of thing, and some trouble had come to you, and here the boss runs up worried about you and calls for your name to see if you'll respond and says, Wayne, servant of the Most High God. Is that how they would think of me? Right? Is this what people think of you? Is this your identity? What do people think of when they think of you? Last night, I was laying there kind of one last time reading through the sermon notes, and I was reading through the sermon or reading through the text here, and I got to that verse, and it didn't strike me before, I was probably 10 or 11 last night, the implications of him saying words like this to Daniel when he got there. It's amazing. It wasn't, "Daniel, you okay?" The first thing out of his mouth was, "You are a servant of the Most High God." Why did he have hope? Why did the king even begin to suspect that this man might be alive still? Because he had a powerful God, and here was a man who was faithful. Notice the last line again in verse 23. What's the reason that Daniel ascribes his having survived the night? It's because he had trusted in the Lord. Right? Is your God able to save? Absolutely. And here's a man who trusted in that kind of God. And so the king comes to him and says, "Servant of the Most High God, has your God been able to deliver you?" Daniel responds, "He shut the mouths of these lions because I trusted in him. And by the way, king, I was innocent before you too. I did nothing wrong." It's interesting. You don't get any sense leading up to that line right there, that when the charges were first leveled against Daniel, that he even gave a defense. Right? What's he going to say? "Yeah, I prayed." He's not trying to defend himself or anything. He just entrusted himself to the Lord. What did Jesus do? Charges, all these charges coming against him, and here he is before Herod and utter not a word, right? But in 1 Peter 2, it refers back to that and says, what does he do instead? But he entrusted his soul to God, his life to God, who is the creator and always does what's right. That is what Daniel did here. "By the way, I was innocent before you. An angel, in fact, God sent to take care of me, right? To shut the mouths of these lions." So similar, again, back to chapter 3 in the story of those three friends of Daniel in the fiery furnace, in that immensely hot oven, where this one had the appearance of a son of man. You remember that? He looked like a fourth man, but then he had, from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, looked like an angel or some kind of son of the gods. an angel sent there even as here. And as there they entered, or they left the fiery furnace without the smell of smoke, here he exits without even a scratch. Indeed, this God is able to deliver. And this pleased the king very much. The conspirators, probably not so much. What did this mean for them? Their conspiracy was an utter failure, total backfire. They were caught in their own trap. Let's read verses 24 and following. So the king gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. And Darius, but these lions, Daniel didn't get out of this because the lions weren't hungry. Right? It wasn't that the lions were sick or starved nearly to death and couldn't muster up the strength to come against Daniel. None of those things were the issue. They had not reached the bottom before their bones were crushed and the lions overpowered them. So Darius the king wrote to all the peoples. Here's how he responds. To all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in the land. May your peace abound, he wrote. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Verse 28, so this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Ongoing political success, in spite of all these factors, in spite of all the threats and risks that were involved. He went from exiled prisoner as a teenage boy to ruler in multiple kingdoms. And yet, on the other hand, such an epic failure of these ones who plotted against this servant of God. These lions were finally able to eat, and did they ever eat? They didn't even reach the bottom of the pit before they were crushed. Remember the story of Haman in the book of Esther? Builds this these gallows to get Mordecai hung because he was jealous of Mordecai. He didn't appreciate Mordecai and the fact that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. And it was Haman who ended up hanging on the gallows. Again, a work of the sovereign God that we serve even to this day. The king's edict is wonderful here, isn't it? Here you have this pagan king who is turned into a biblical poet because of his witnessing of what God had done. And contrast it with his earlier edict to force all the people of the nation to submit to him in prayer and praise, honoring him as though he were a god. And now God is glorified once again for being his sovereign. Sovereign even over the king of Persia here. Incredible story. He is the living God and enduring forever. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Let's pray. This is indeed our God. Our God who is able to deliver. Our God who is sovereign over our nation and the rulers of this world which we now live in. A God who takes kings and raises them up and kings and destroys them, puts them down. Empires and kingdoms, they rise and fall all at your will. To accomplish your purposes for this world. Lord, we want to submit ourselves to you. And we want to be marked with the kind of integrity that marked Daniel. A willingness to submit to your rule over our lives. And to trust in your good providence for where you have us. We thank you that we can praise a God like you. And even as this great king so long ago had learned through the testimony of this man's life and your demonstration of immense power, we honor you and praise you as the God who is indeed able to do all things. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.